the first thing to do for everyone who isn't initiated in English history, and that will probably be most people, is that you have to explain what the Glorious Revolution was. The Glorious Revolution, a very basic summary, is this. In 1688, the Catholic King of England, James II, was removed by essentially a threat of force by a Protestant invader, by the ruler of the Dutch Republic, William of Orange. William of Orange was James's nephew, and he was married to James's daughter. And after the revolution, as part of the revolution, James fled in exile to France, and then Parliament voted in as co-monarchs, William and Mary. And this revolution is really part of the English national myth. It's seen as part of classical liberalism, it's seen as part of establishing a limited, balanced constitution, and most libertarians really accept it as a good thing. Most so-called beltway libertarians accept that the Glorious Revolution was necessary to remove England of a very tyrannical king. Even some libertarians probably go so far as to defend the murder of Charles I in 1649. Briefly, I'd say, just in response to that, is that it's okay to defend things that are bad, but you have to actually look at what follows them. And if you defend something even worse, then that's not the right way to approach something. The Macaulay view of the Glorious Revolution, Thomas Babington Macaulay was one of the great Whig historians of the 19th century. His view is really still the popular view. He was summarising what was already believed by a lot of people, but he's really shaped the viewpoint on the Glorious Revolution, and it's broadly speaking this, that in his short reign, 3 years as king, James II sought to undermine the English ancient constitution. By that he means English civil liberties. He also accuses James of being essentially a slave or a mercenary of Louis XIV of France. He accuses him of various particular things, such as having a large standing army during peacetime and trying to overawe the city of London with it. He accuses James also of cynically using the language of religious toleration to essentially, if not force England to become Catholic, at least force the vast majority of the English people to be ruled by Catholics. There's a lot you can, I could carry on. There are a lot of allegations against James II. You'll find many of the allegations against him in the Bill of Rights in 1689. Like many bills of rights, they start with a legitimation of the change from one order to another. It's startlingly similar to the preface to the Declaration of Independence, again with a long list of things that George III probably didn't do. But still, many libertarians support this revolution, and I take issue with the Whiggish claim for two reasons. One is I don't accept the facts that they claim are facts, and two, I don't accept, even if those facts were true, what they draw from those facts. In short, I'll come to a defense of this position in a minute, but in short, I don't believe that James II was a tyrant, and even if he was, by all the measures of tyranny that the Whigs used, I don't believe that the removal of an absolute monarch and the replacement of an absolute monarch with essentially a parliamentary oligarchy or constitutional republicanism or constitutional monarchy is in any way an improvement. So against the Whig mythical, the idea of this mythical ancient constitution, you can say two things really. The Whigs see this evolution of the ancient constitution starting in the 16th century really, or not starting but making huge strides. And they see a lot of it starting with the Reformation. A good date to use is 1540, when the Reformation actually really starts. It has started nominally a bit earlier, with Henry VIII officially nationalising the Catholic Church in England, but it only really got underway when he started to confiscate and then sell off the church lands. And from this date, you see two really negative developments. The first is ubiquitous religious intolerance. You see the persecution of Roman Catholics, and you see the persecution of various Protestant dissenters. And the Protestant dissenters were those Protestants who did not fall within the established Church of Anglicanism. And so you get various laws, a set of laws which came into effect, for instance, about 20 years before James became king, were known as the Clarendon Code. These included a new set of penal laws. Shortly after that, there was the Test Act. Various laws which prevented Catholics and dissenters from, for instance, being employed in certain occupations or moving from a town to a city or a city to a town. Really, you'd be shocked, even compared against the standards of today, just how much of the average person's life, if they weren't an Anglican, would have been regulated by these laws. Another effect which came into being pretty soon after the Reformation, or as part of it, was the rise of the gentry. The church lands that Henry confiscated were bought up by a new class of people called the gentry, and they quickly gained economic and then political power. It's a historical controversy whether the 17th century was defined more than anything by the rise of the gentry or not, but it was very important. Such was the case that by 1660 and the so-called restoration of the monarchy, they were able to essentially effect a revolution whereby all the feudal dues that they had traditionally had to pay to the king were swept aside. So their class of people then transferred all the burdens of paying for the state, not from themselves, to the bulk of ordinary people. And they replaced this with an excise tax on consumption. The gentry dominated the commons, the House of Commons, which was one of the Houses of Parliament. They were the richest 10% in the country. Also around this time, they started to encroach on the royal forest, and they completely dispossessed a class in England known as the yeomanry, who were a large group of small landowners who had something like a freehold over their land on the manor. If you look for a dictionary definition of yeoman, it says commoners who cultivate their own land. And so by essentially asking them to justify their land ownership, many of them had held this land for generations, but by asking them to provide proof of this, which of course they couldn't prove because many of them were illiterate, many of them didn't know where to get any of the parchments they needed, they were dispossessed. So that was one of the main classes against James II. You can make a number of defences of James II, but one of the main ones is really that he was, in my view, a sincere advocate of religious toleration. You don't need to look too far. You can look at his memoirs. You can look at accounts of what he said to other people. You can look at his letters to people. Nowhere really do I see, apart from people who were actively opposed to him, any representation of his views which suggests that he wasn't in favour of a complete, what was known as a liberty of conscience. In one correspondence with Gilbert Burnet, for instance, he described persecution for conscience's sake as being opposed, as being contrary to his own conscience. He also explained to someone he just wanted to leave people alone so that they could go about their daily business regardless of their religion. You can also just look at his conduct in America, where he had a great deal of influence because he inherited or was granted control of a number of states. And wherever he had influence, he made sure that there was religious toleration. He was really public enemy number one of the Massachusetts Puritan class. He offered refuge to Puritans, or rather apostate Puritans, if you like, and he was a good friend of various Protestant dissenters like William Penn. So none of this really accords with the Whig view that James was some kind of Catholic bigot who wanted to persecute anyone who wasn't a Catholic. It's also suggested that he was a slave of France. Well, no, he wasn't, because he took £40,000 in total from Louis XIV, But this was the arrears of Charles II's payments. This was the money that was meant to be paid to Charles II. He didn't ask for any more money from Charles II. And really, in terms of international affairs, James didn't want any wars at all. He even tried to stay out of any kind of military entanglements, either with the Dutch Republic or with Louis XIV of France. And the accusation that James was in bed with both of the with either of these two powers is ridiculous when you consider that most of the people who were making these accusations were themselves taking money from either the Dutch or the French. I'm talking about members of the House of Commons or the House of Lords. Many of them were taking payments from both sides at the same time. It's also alleged that James believed in the divine right of kings and therefore in absolute monarchy. This view seems to be totally confused on a number of levels, because the divine right of kings isn't, properly speaking, a Catholic view. It isn't a Catholic idea. It really came to the fore after the Reformation. Catholics believe in the divine right, but they believe in the divine right of the Pope. It was always the case that the Catholic Church was some limitation on the power of the state. Also, the suggestion that James was trying to emulate Louis XIV's model of a bureaucratic absolutist state is ridiculous on two levels. Firstly, the suggestion that was a Catholic ambition, because Louis XIV was emulating the Protestants in trying to build a French state church. And also because James II was nowhere near having enough revenue to fund that. James II took about 4% of GDP a year, whereas Louis XIV took 15%. With 4% of GDP at the time, you couldn't have afforded a big, despotic, authoritarian, centralized state. Indeed, James was, in some respects, by the standards of the time, and considering that he was in charge of a state, an economic libertarian. Sir William Petty, who was one of the great economists of the time, approached him and said, "I really think you should increase taxes. I think it wouldn't be an intolerable burden if the people were to be taxed and you were to get 5% of GDP rather than 3.5% or 4%. And James's reply was simply, "No, I'm not going to raise taxes. If people become wealthier and more productive, then I will get more money. But I have no intentions of raising taxes in order to increase my revenue." Also, which was quite unique at the time, James was committed to paying off Charles's debts, which again is symptomatic of his frame of mind. He viewed the government as his private possession. He was a private governor. He viewed the country as his, even if Parliament didn't let him act that way all the time. And so imagine if Hillary Clinton was trying to get elected in order to own the amount of US public debt is. I somehow don't think she'd be advocating all the spending that she's advocating. Equally so, if Theresa May was personally liable for the £1.7 trillion national debt, she wouldn't be advocating widening the budget deficit. Another accusation made against James is that he tried to pack Parliament, that is, fill it with his supporters. I'll accept that. Yes, he did, but then every king did. And when the king didn't actively do it, a group of other people would do it. The parliamentarians would try to rig the election themselves. So, for instance, in 1680, Charles II took quite a lax view of the general election, and then the Whig aristocrats fixed all the elections and messed about with the boroughs and charters, and they got a very strong Whig opposition to Charles and tried to exclude James from succeeding. Also, the assumption that Parliament's somehow better is ridiculous, with Belloc arguing that this was just that Parliament at the time was just an oligarchy of rich families of squires and merchants. It's also argued that James wanted to abolish habeas corpus. And again, this is just a misrepresentation of the facts. He didn't ever advocate that. He advocated the same suspensions of habeas corpus as any other king had ever advocated. Another accusation made by English classical liberals and Whigs and so forth against James II is that he wanted essentially to give Ireland away to the Irish. Again, I don't think that's a terribly bad idea in the 17th century, when the dispossession of large amounts of Irish land was still fresh in a lot of people's memory. So I don't believe James was a tyrant. I don't believe he was trying to achieve some kind of allegedly Catholic, absolutist, bureaucratic state. He was more in line with what Belloc called popular monarchy. And he defined popular monarchy as a monarchy that doesn't tax. Or he was in line with Tolkien's unconstitutional monarchy. So, according to the facts, the revolution was unnecessary on the Whigs' own terms, because many of the things that they used to justify the revolution either didn't happen or were common practice. What really disturbed James's opponents was his dispensing and suspending power of laws, which was a great limit on the statist ambitions of Parliament, his Catholicism, which potentially could have been a limitation on the Anglican Tory establishment, and he didn't want a war, which again was a limit on statism. Belloc argues that James was especially nationalist in terms of European monarchs for the time, in a time of almost universal cosmopolitanism among the ruling classes of Europe. And so, I think the revolution I mentioned about the Restoration not too long ago, I think this revolution most likely started in 1660 with the restoration of the monarchy after the fall of the Puritan rule of England and the Commonwealth. I think you can generally see a forewarning of revolutions before they're coming. I think I would broadly agree with Sean, at least I think Sean thinks this, that the Thatcher revolution was to some extent a warning of the Blair revolution, and Blair again took many of the things that Thatcher did, added more to it, but was really taking some of the things to their natural conclusion. And so far from the Glorious Revolution being conservative or libertarian or restoring, it was destructive, and it was unpopular. When William of Orange from the Netherlands invaded, he didn't get all that much support. It was really among the upper echelons of society that he won people over and then just effected a coup d'etat. And so the revolution wasn't restoring or libertarian, and it therefore gave rise to a certain amount of regime uncertainty, and through its introduction of elements of democracy led to conflict through the ballot box. As Steven Pinkus argues, far from making government more predictable, it instantiated one of the most polarised and unstable periods in English history. The revolution gave birth to the rage of party. Pinkus also argues that, he also notes that one contemporary observer wrote of the period after the revolution thus: "The British were a nation so divided into parties that no one is allowed any good quality by the opposite side." And of course, after the revolution, various special privileges were granted to various commercial interests. For instance, the English textile industry was given protection in the Calico Act. Then various special deals were granted to people who wanted to build roads and canals, all of whom had various dodgy connections to William of Orange. And again, with the introduction of democracy, you surprisingly early, you start to see the balance of power shifting downwards. John Aubrey, who was a contemporary, said the balance of the government is quite altered and put into the hands of the common man. Also incorporating elements of the public choice school into looking at the revolution. Revolutions are usually about self-interest. They're very rarely about abstract ideas. They're usually about the self-interest of the people carrying out the revolution. And so the opponents of toleration included a self-interested William of Orange, whose main interest was to bring the weight of England, its army and its economy, against the French, a long enemy of his, and he did achieve that afterwards. Also, I might note, when Jason Jewell gave quite an interesting talk on a subject similar to this, he noted that William of Orange was a homosexual. But then he said, I will decline to comment on how that may have affected his rate of time preference in light of Professor Hopper's experience in that regard. There were other self-interested revolutionaries, which include various hardcore Whigs. Henry Kerr, one of James's Whig supporters, one of the more moderate Whigs, saw opposition to tolerance as a cover for self-interest. As Scott Sowerby notes, their dislike of toleration stemmed from self-interest and their desire to monopolise political power by pushing dissenters out of lucrative public offices. He also then goes on to quote Kerr himself, and Kerr mocks the opponents of toleration. He's pretending to be a Whig opponent of toleration now. He says, "We've got a jolly good number of laws on our sides, whereby we have engrossed to our own party all the preferments of the nation, the power to crush all other persuasions, and we have found the sweets hereof for many years, and made the dissenters of all sorts tremble before us." And these laws are, of course, the Corporation Acts, the Uniformity Act, and various long-standing acts against the Roman Catholics. And so Sowerby acknowledges that that this opposition to toleration may have been a cover for selfish ambition. So really, to start to conclude, the Glorious Revolution was really about an emerging political class versus the monarchy. Eric von Kuhnelt-Ledin said there is in all aristocracies to a certain extent a republican undercurrent. And it's interesting that both Tories and Whigs opposed James II, Tories ostensibly being more pro-monarchy. Von Kuhnelt-Ledin says Britain post-1688 was a disguised oligarchic republic or a camouflaged aristocratic republic. So the revolution was also a foreign takeover of Britain, with William of Orange then waging a very long and very costly war against France. The war costing £40 million, which was about £5 million a year. To put that into context, James was very rarely able to get £2 million a year from as a parliament through supply. And so accordingly, after the revolution, taxes went up, government spending went up massively. By the year of the establishment of the Bank of England in 1694, government spending as a percentage of GDP had gone up to about 15%, which was certainly more than Louis XIV's France. And so to fund this massive increase in debt, and also for various reasons that central banks are usually established for, the Bank of England was established. Also, what also followed the Glorious Revolution was a series of legitimizing measures which usually follow revolutions. So, for instance, there was a fake Toleration Act. A toleration means you tolerate everything that's tolerable. So that ought to have included every single religious sect or as close to that as possible. And that was what James II was arguing for, and I do believe that he would have been successful because William invaded England 3 weeks before polling day, just as he was about to elect a parliament that was very likely to be successful in repealing all the religious legislation. And so it's quite ironic that the revolution settlement the laws after the revolution then included a fake Toleration Act, but so it's instructed that it didn't include Roman Catholics. Also, to legitimise the Glorious Revolution, there was, again, a legitimising Bill of Rights. These are never any good, because They just list all the things you can do. They don't list what you can't do. And you often find that there are an enormous amount of things that you can't do. Also with codified constitutional measures like this, it's quite difficult to find what the state can't do. So following the revolution, you essentially got the establishment of a republic. William and Mary were elected as co-monarchs, and William had no place in the succession. He was just married to someone in the succession, but he was allowed to become a co-monarch. Also, in the Act of Settlement afterwards, James II's eldest son, who was going to be raised a Catholic, he was excluded from the succession. They passed over 50 possible successors to the throne on the basis of them being Roman Catholics. So the revolution of 1688 was essentially a move from absolute monarchy to constitutional monarchy. It formalized and codified the statism of the time, and quite surprisingly, it was legitimized by John Locke. The revolution was anti-monarchy, it was anti-Catholic, it was republican, it was backed by a broad coalition of interests who profited financially from it, from mercantile interests to the landed interests, also various foreign interests, as it led to a war. And so one main thing that I would just say in terms of strategy is that revolutions, again, are very rarely about abstract ideas. They're almost universally about the profit or the power of the people who lobby for the revolutions or participate in them. Statist means cannot achieve libertarian or conservative ends. And so the idea of a conservative or a restoring revolution is not only, in this case, incorrect in terms of the actual facts, but is impossible in theory. Thank you.